The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to this live edition of the Seneca Podcast, coming to you today from the China Institute in Manhattan. Let's hear you folks make a little noise. All right. That's a little noise. All right. Thank you so much to our good friends here at the China Institute for co-sponsoring this event. I am Kaiser Guo, and I am joined, of course, by Jeremy Goldhorn, a man who is speculatively stockpiling pre-tariff steel and aluminum in a giant warehouse on his land in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeremy, greet the people.
Hello, people. You can come and live in my warehouse when the nuclear war starts.
What else are you stockpiling there? I don't even want to know. I don't really want to know. Jeremy, tell our friends about SubChina Access.
Yeah, just briefly, SubChina Access is our new membership program. You get a members-only newsletter once a week, and we're going to be upping that to more than once a week in the near future. You get access to Slack, the Slack software, where you can chat with our editorial team anytime you like. And you get steep discounts to live events, not free ones like this one, but ones that you would otherwise have to pay a lot of money for. So I'd really like to encourage you all to join. We are trying to build a community of people who care about China, and we're really keen to have new members.
You also get early releases of the podcast, so you get them on Monday or Tuesday instead of having to wait till Thursday or Friday. So let's jump right in, shall we, into this topic. So at any given time in recent years, some 300,000 plus students from the People's Republic of China are attending universities here in the United States. A great many of them, I dare say probably most of them, study, they make friends, they explore America, perhaps they fall in love and either remain here to continue their studies or to work, or they return to China along with many other sea turtles, and they often have their horizons vastly broadened. They have new ideas, new perspectives, and are filled with new entrepreneurial energies. So when they head back.
Of course, that's the ideal case, and it's appropriate that Kaiser makes the sunny case while I make the negative case, because the truth is also that many Chinese students feel intense alienation and social isolation here in the United States. Sometimes they even experience racism and prejudice, not only from people of other races and ethnicities, but even from Chinese from other parts of Greater China or from Chinese Americans.
So as tensions between China and the United States rise, the experience of Chinese students in America is receiving an increasing amount of attention. They are more and more assertive, these Chinese students are, about their own political beliefs, whether they drink deeply of American political culture and come to embrace its values and its institutions, or whether they become defensive, as is often the case, about China when confronted with attitudes and ideas about their own country, and especially about its government, that are fundamentally at odds with what they've been brought up to believe. They often take very grave offense at how professors, for example, in classrooms, or their American classmates or other students from China talk about China. Some really bristle or even protest very loudly at who, for example, is invited to campus to speak.
And of course, the students come under pressure from a number of other sources. Recent allegations in the media have surfaced about the rule that groups like CSSAs, the Chinese Students and Scholar Associations, have played on campuses. Their relations or supposed relations with the Chinese embassy and consulates and with Chinese government bureaus and intelligence services. Endowments from wealthy and politically connected Chinese are also under scrutiny in the United States right now, as, of course, are China's Confucius Institutes.
And in reaction to revelations about CSSA and other Chinese influence or interference operations, Chinese students in the U.S. are now coming under political pressure and some scrutiny. FBI Director Christopher Wray was testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee not long ago, and he spoke of a whole-of-society threat from China, not just a whole-of-government, but a whole-of-society threat. And I think that there's an imminent risk, if not indeed already a reality already upon us, of racial profiling, of a Red Scare, of a new McCarthyism, of a significant uptick in anti-Chinese or even anti-East Asian hate crime here in America. So we have lots to talk about, obviously, and fortunately, two of the best people I know to talk about these issues with. These are two people who have studied the Chinese student experience in the U.S. pretty extensively. So first of all, we'd like to welcome Sishi Tu, who's actually working on Chinese high school students in the U.S., but has, of course, not only experienced university here herself, but has also thought and written about it extensively. So Sishi, welcome to Seneca.
Hi, good to be here.
And we are delighted to welcome back Eric Fish, author of China's Millennials, who lived in China for many years and is now working on his second book about Chinese university students. Eric wrote an excellent long-form piece for SubChina about this topic, which we titled Caught in a Crossfire, Chinese Students Abroad and the Battle for Their Hearts. We'll link to that on the podcast page. We are really looking forward to your new book. Welcome back to Seneca, Eric.
Great to be back.
Sichi, this is your first time on Seneca, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, your own history of study here in the United States, and what got you interested in researching and writing about this Chinese student experience in the U.S.
Okay, so I am a PhD candidate in sociology at CUNY DeGrasse Center, and my dissertation research is on Chinese students coming to U.S. for private high schools because they are only allowed to get a degree from a private institution, not a public institution, for secondary education. I got interested in them because I observed a lot of family friends sending their kids as early as, you know, 10, 12, 14 to the U.S. alone for school. So you definitely expect that they have very emotional and complicated experience here at school. That's why I start to research them. Also, the parents' piece is interesting to me as well because they are the rising Chinese upper middle class, right? And that gets us wonder why do they make the decisions to send their kids here? And also, I'm interested is also because I have a personal experience studying here. I go to Columbia for my master's degree and then my doctorate degree at a CUNY. So I kind of can understand their experience from an older age, but I keep wondering how could it be if you're that young? That's basically my story of why I get interested in this topic.
And you're originally from Shanghai, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. So, Eric, you're working on another book right now, and it's on the specific topic that we're talking about tonight, right? How's that coming along? And tell us about the research that you're doing for it.
Slowly but surely. I did a book on Chinese youth when I was in China, and I thought it was just fascinating how the massive socioeconomic changes unfolding in the country were affecting young people's outlooks, ideology, just everything. And then it was really fascinating when I came back here to kind of see when you add this foreign environment to it and everything that comes with American society, how that shakes up ideology, influence, and whatnot. So that's what I'm kind of looking at is the Chinese student experience themselves. How are young Chinese coming here from that environment in China? How are they being influenced? And then the other side of that is the numbers have exploded so rapidly. It went from about 60,000 Chinese university students 10 years ago to about 350,000 now. So just this massively quick uptick in numbers. And that's really upended a lot of universities in a lot of ways, good and bad. So that's the other side of it, how it's affecting American higher ed, and then also greater U.S.-China relations. Like I wrote about in that piece, I think there is some conventional wisdom that if Chinese come to the U.S., they'll adopt a more liberal political point of view, take that back to China. But then there's been another side to that lately, that they come here, get disillusioned, and go back more nationalistic than in the first place. And just kind of seen how neither one of those is quite wrong or quite right, but it's very complicated. So that's what I'm trying
Eric,
to dig
can
into.
I just go back to the numbers? You said 350,000. Does that include high school students, or is that just tertiary
institutions? That's just
institutions?
Tertiary.
That's just, yeah, well. Wow.
There's 60,000 high school students.
60,000.
Yeah, that's a roughly over 60,000 high school students, and you probably miss a couple of them because some of them have green cards and things like that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, so these are Chinese nationals who are studying in the United States. Interesting. So the students who came from China back in my day are very different from the ones who are coming here today. Back then, it was really the cream of the crop. It was really only the very, very top students, you know, who had to, it was quite onerous to be able to actually test in and get a scholarship from the United States to come here to study, in addition to, you know, the costs of travel and living and so forth. You know, I imagine that they're a lot more diverse right now, the students who are in China, and many are still sort of getting in for sure on the sheer strength of their academic performance, but there were others whose parents, you know, pretty early on opt out of the Gaokao, the college exam track, and decide, I mean, my sister-in-law, her kids, they've already decided he's not going to go Gaokao track, he's going to study in the United States. I mean, they've decided, and he's only 6 or 7 years old right now. You know, I mean, really, there are people who can afford to basically buy their way in to the U.S. education system as well. So what changed in China, in the United States, in the respective educational institutions of these two countries to make this happen, to make this number just shoot up, as you say, by more than like 5 times in just a decade? What's changed with immigration policy, with the job market, with other drivers I'm sure that I'm missing, to see so many Chinese students now in the U.S.? And what were sort of the inflection points along the way?
I would say one of the big inflection points, one of the big changes from the U.S. side was the financial crisis. And all of a sudden, there was a ton of state funding that was lost for universities. So all of a sudden, universities realized they need to make up that money somehow. So that's been a big kind of point of contention with this influx. And Chinese students are about 1/3 of international students now, by far the highest proportion, double from India. So that was one kind of pull factor. But this came at the same time. The economy is still growing very quickly in China. More and more people are entering the middle class. And I think over the last 10 years, especially, there has been this kind of national introspection about the Gaokao, about the college entrance exam in China, and how hard it is on young people. And I think this is really kind of a lot of parents have started to see, this education system can be quite brutal and not leave students with as well-rounded as of an education as they can get in the U.S. So that's kind of pushing a lot here as well. So yeah, I think it's a combination of push and pull factors.
So it's like, my kid is an underachiever, so let's send him to the U.S. Or my kid is an overachiever, so let's send him to the U.S.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there is this perception, too, that you can get much more opportunities with a foreign degree. I think the gap is kind of starting to close. You see the income gap where you can get with a domestic Chinese and a foreign degree kind
that
of shrinking.
The highway bump is shrinking now.
Yeah, but yeah, so more people now that I talk to don't cite so much the job opportunities, but just like the more well-rounded education experience that they can get here.
Siqi, if I can turn to you, and at the risk of generalization, I think it's pretty safe to say that students from China are typically less extroverted, shall we say, than your average American student. How has the presence of so many Chinese students changed social interaction between international students from China and American students? Or because they can find large social circles of people who speak their native language, is there now actually less interaction between Chinese and American students?
Yeah, so I think it depends on what kind of school or college they went to, right? Usually, I think when there are a large Chinese students' presence, they're very, very likely to stick with the Chinese students because, you know, it's culturally closer and some of them haven't passed their language barrier yet. It's easier for them to communicate with other Chinese students. In other cases, say if they went to a more rural place in the high school setting, then they might go to places that don't have that many Chinese students, then they were kind of forced to socialize more with the American students. So it might have some positive effects on them. You know, they tend to participate in sports events with their American teenagers, and they also will probably try harder to understand American pop culture, you know, by watching more TV or whatever, to try to understand all the cultural reference. So that is, like, I think there is a regional difference, and also the critical mass of presence of Chinese students on campus.
So staying with you, what are some of the other social issues that Chinese students typically face on American campuses? I mean, I was recently on a campus and talking to a group of Chinese students who all told me that there's this big divide between the students from mainland China and people like me, ABCs, as they call them, American-born Chinese. They said, you know, 那些 ABC 不带我们玩，they don't play with, or they don't hang out with us. They don't invite us to hang out with them. Many of them told me that. And also, what about relations between Chinese from mainland China and from Taiwan or from Hong Kong. And I mean, I remember back when I was in college in the 1980s, it was already very divided. It was really rare to see people from Hong Kong and Taiwan even hanging out together. And there were the few mainland students had nothing to do with them.
Yeah, so I think the ABC case is probably true. Like, I mean, it still varies, right? Because there are some Chinese students who play with all American students, including ABCs, but they do complain about how ABCs are trying to differentiate themselves from other Chinese students, right? This is the idea of ABC is trying really hard to say, we are not ABC, we are Americans, right? So they don't want to be associated with this whole Chinese identity, especially when there's a lot of Chinese students on campus and a lot of...
They do that when they go to China, too. It's really annoying.
Yeah.
You know, they see a group of white people and they start speaking English in a really pronounced American accent really loudly, just like to make sure... somebody knows their worst form of snobbery.
And I think for the Taiwan and Hong Kong piece is more like case by case, because first of all, I think there are less Taiwan and Hong Kong students nowadays than before. So the mainland Chinese sometimes are like overwhelmed everywhere. So sometimes they might just want to, you know, eat Chinese food, so they have to hang out with mainland Chinese students. But in other cases, I think especially in terms of political views, they're apparently very different, so they might not get along as well. And I think there's another interesting piece that you guys kind of mentioned earlier, is there might be a regional divide as well within China, right?
Yeah.
It's like, when there are critical amount of Chinese students on campus, they can choose to hang out with people from their own regions, right? So they can speak their local dialect. I was thinking of this because you mentioned Hong Kongese, so maybe they can speak Cantonese with Canton students from Canton, but not from with Shanghainese, right?
Right.
So that's another kind of linguistic culture piece to the story.
And just like in China, you Shanghainese only hang out with yourselves, right? You exclude everyone else.
That's
right?
Not true.
Okay, what about racism? You know, since Trump's election, we've seen a lot of unpleasant incidents across the country that have targeted people of all kinds of non-white races. What about Chinese? I mean, is this something that Chinese people, Chinese students are concerned about? Have either of you talked to people who've experienced racist behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a lot of students who've experienced outright overt racism, being called racial slurs and whatnot. I think more often, though, it's like microaggressions, and I think it can be especially hurtful.
Can you define that for an old man?
A microaggression
is microaggression?
Like when my dad would be shopping in a big box store and someone would come up and say, "Excuse me, sir, but you look like you would know something about computers."
Right. Yeah, I don't know how much the students I've talked to who've been around since before and after Trump, I don't think have noticed a huge uptick. I did hear some stories from around that time of white supremacists on campus going around saying really nasty things. I don't know how much of an effect that has had on the average Chinese student. But one thing a lot who have kind of trouble with is, I mean, something I can kind of relate to is like when I first went to China as a white American male, like I had never experienced racism at all, any kind of discrimination in the U.S. My identity was pretty much what I made of it. But then when I went to China, I kind of had all this baggage thrust upon me based on whatever people think of that background. But of course, for me in China, it's basically white privilege on steroids, so it wasn't that big of a deal. But for Chinese coming to the U.S., I think it can be quite jarring, just kind of the beliefs a lot of people have about China, and just all of a sudden you become Chinese and you have this baggage thrust upon you that you'd never thought about.
Right.
So the Chinese label and also the Asian stereotypes, just very few Chinese have this concept of Asian identity, but then that's thrust upon them. So a lot of things, just people asking even basic questions about China, I think can be a little off-putting, and especially when people have certain misconceptions about China, and there is a lot of misconceptions I found by Americans still of what life is like in China, thinking it's like it still was during, like it was during the Mao era.
Eat dogs.
Right. People get their hands cut off if they're caught stealing. Just all kinds of things like this. And I think a lot of Chinese are quite taken aback at how negative a lot of Americans' views of China are. And that can kind of hurt at a personal level when you start to realize, I think, that people see me as Chinese. That's part of my identity that didn't really think about before.
Sushi, maybe you can answer this. The fact that Chinese students are now coming to the U.S. from more developed, you know, a more developed, a more wealthy, a more confident China, that must have changed something, though,
yeah.
In a way. Yeah.
I think the most interesting I heard is a lot of students always say, oh, I think China is way better. Like, I can't wait to go back to China, because apparently a lot of these students go to rural area or suburban area for schools. Right, so they didn't see the very prosperous part of America. So they were like, this place is so boring. You know, they don't have, because they mainly come from Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, you know, big cities like New York City. So they found like America to be like way boring than they imagined.
Yeah, this is my daughter who calls Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Da Nong Chang.
Yeah, they basically call,
I mean, she's right.
Yeah, they call a lot of campus like Cun Li, right? They say like, I'm Cun going Li, back yeah. to the village. They might be unleashed for a while to go to New York, you know, for a week during their Thanksgiving, but then they're going back, they'll say, oh, 回村里了, like, you know, going back to the village and feeling very depressed about, you know, like having to go back to a backward lifestyle that they're not familiar with.
Makes sense. Maybe related to the question of racism, what about the reaction of other students on campus to this large influx of international students from mainland China? Do you think that other students, particularly American students, are starting to feel that they're sort of being overwhelmed by this mass of Chinese students? And sort of related to that, I mean, in terms of participation in the community, a complaint I've heard in New Zealand a lot, where I have family, there's, you know, a very big Chinese presence, particularly in the capital, Auckland, very, very noticeable, particularly on the campuses. And the New Zealanders don't, you know, despite recent media articles, there's not much of a red scare or yellow peril. It's not like the US or Australia, I feel. But New Zealanders are very concerned that the Chinese students and immigrants don't seem to want to participate in community activities. Do you have this kind of sense on American campuses?
Yeah, so I just spent a week at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which is the most Chinese university in the U.S. right now, almost 6,000 Chinese students. And there was this kind of everybody that I talked to, kind of the Chinese students, the faculty, the locals, kind of sense that there's this kind of separate bubble where the Chinese kind of hang together. And it's not universal at all, but it is something kind of everybody seems to recognize. And I did hear a lot of kind of negative stereotypes associated with the influx of Chinese students. One of the most common was that Chinese students are really rich, just here to waste their parents' money. And that's kind of reinforced by there's a handful of kids on campus with Ferraris and Maseratis and kind of flashy cars. So that kind of reinforces this idea that Chinese are spoiled rich kids. And there has been some growing pains, what everybody was saying at the university, trouble in class, adjusting to students coming from a very different educational background. And some local students have complained about that. And there is also this perception that with the influx of Chinese, that's taking spots away from local students. That's usually not really the case, but there is this perception that we're selling out our university. In fact, at the University of Illinois a few months ago, there was this bus advertisement that got a lot of play, where they listed one of the advantages of their buses as you won't feel like you're in China when you're on our buses. And they then issued a quote-unquote apology afterwards, saying that while we find different ethnicities valuable, we're not comfortable with selling out our university to the highest foreign bidder. And these Chinese students put a lot of burdens on classrooms that kind of dilute the experience.
Wait,
for
this
local
is what
students.
The bus company said?
This is the bus company. What? They,
I mean, they couldn't have just said, oh, what we actually meant was crowded. That's all.
No, they just really waded back deep into that debate. And it was interesting, like, talking to people in the community about that ad, because I was kind of like, how widespread of an opinion is this? And it was kind of like, well, that bus company's crazy in the first place. It's kind of well known. But there are some people who have that feeling. But I think what was more overwhelming, though, was they kind of said, well, most people, especially on the university, especially the students, kind of jumped in and jumped to Chinese students' defense and said, like, there's no place for this racism in our community.
So
I was kind of surprised. There are a lot of stereotypes, but there is a lot of
woke people
kind of,
too.
Right.
Yeah, that's good. Excellent. I know, Sushi, we're talking about university students, and your work is on private high school students. Are some of the things that we're talking about, they must apply also to the high school students you've been talking to also, like the race experience, the sort of exclusion? Can we lump them in, kind of?
Yeah. I think the what we call like racialization process for these students and or any international student, that's kind of universal, right? Like you come to a new country and then, like, because the society itself is super racialized, you're forced to, you know, choose a category, right? So you were never Asian before, but now you're Asian, right? Everyone like treat you as Asian, and then they kind of put their idea of model minority or whatever on you, and then that you must be good at math. Why are you? Oh, it's weird that you're good at arts, right? All these kind of things right. going on, like for any high school students, and you can observe this in most of the math clubs. In these schools, like they're overwhelmingly Chinese or Chinese and Koreans. So it's like, you know, they still like kind of like almost become a self-fulfilled prophecy, like, you know, by responding to the stereotype. So they are good at math. So they join math club. They go to math competition and all these kind of things. And I think also it's pretty hard for them to break it, because I remember a boy telling me that he tried really hard to go to a football varsity team. And he practiced like day after day after day. And at the end, he got in. But then he said just like on the bus ride to the field, he feels so segregated. He said like no one has been talking to him. And then he said, whatever, I'm going to drop out and go back to my comfortable junior varsity team, which are all international students.
And join the math club.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's really not fair. I mean, not all Chinese people are good at math. Only most of us.
It's true. So, if we can go back to university students, what about their engagement in American politics? You know, a generation ago, the earlier waves of Chinese students who came here tended to shy away completely from politics and not get involved at all. But this is a very different generation. Has that changed? And if it has, you know, how do you think the current generation of Chinese students, how are they making sense of American politics, which is a rather special time?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, again, it's so diverse now. I think that's one of the things that marks this generation, is just the diversity of ideological outlooks and levels of interest in politics. I would say the plurality probably kind of looks on at American politics with detached bemusement, kind of watching what goes on, but not so much into it, I don't know, are not participating as much, but I think that's changing. I thought it was interesting during the last election, there were like Chinese students that were getting involved in campaigns. Not a huge number, but there does seem to be a growing kind of engagement interest in American politics and also in campus politics. I was just at Purdue as well, and there was this tuition hike for international students a few years back, and the Chinese student group organized kind of a protest, and you saw a lot of Chinese students out there with signs, so getting involved in campus politics more as well, I think, kind of challenging that perception that
at least the pocketbook issues of China.
Yeah, and I think I don't want to overgeneralize it, but I think there are some variables that come into play. For example, if you come to here early, like the high school students generally are more involved in politics because they kind of see through, you know, in their student leadership and election, all these kind of things, and a lot of them will run for the student leadership as well, you know, partly for their college application. And also, I think the other thing is depending on what kind of major you study, right? Especially those study social sciences tend to be more into, you know, American politics, and some of the, in general, STEM major students tend to shy away from politics. They usually will tell you, I just come to the U.S. to study, then I'll go back. I don't want to know anything, you know, like outside of this box. But apparently there are others who are more into it, right?
I think that's a point worth noting, too, about majors, whereas in the past it was overwhelmingly like STEM fields, science, engineering, math, that kind of thing. But you see a lot more Chinese students now going into like liberal arts, fields like political science, journalism, things that aren't going to bring a huge paycheck, but are kind of pursuing their interests or pursuing things they find kind of have a higher meaning in their own eyes. So I think that's one interesting development.
That kind of tie back to usually sometimes it's also because they have certain economic basis to support it, right? Like their parents are not like looking forward to them to have a huge paycheck, bring back and support a whole family kind of thing, right? So they usually, the Chinese parents today are more supportive in their kids choosing whatever they like, even like, you know, arts and humanities that doesn't necessarily bring them, you know, like a high pay career, right?
Right, so it's 小明，你爸爸妈妈有钱，你可以去学 sociology, right? Okay, now related to the Chinese parents here, now one of the issues, even if the Chinese students themselves aren't necessarily participating in droves in American politics, one political issue in America that has their parents really, really up in arms is affirmative action. This is like a gigantic driving issue. Are university and especially high school students themselves, is this something of concern to them as they're looking at college applications or as they're looking at admissions to graduate programs as undergraduates? Are they concerned about affirmative action? And do they realize that this issue of affirmative action is just basically the right using them as a bludgeon?
Yeah, I think the parents I interviewed, first of all, most of the Chinese parents are not woke, right? So they don't understand what's the like racial hierarchies, like why
they're sound asleep, yeah.
Yeah, why like affirmative action exists in the first place. So they will go along with the like more like conservative narrative of it's hurting us, like my kid is not getting into the universities, no, you know, like my kids cannot go to Harvard because of the affirmative action. But on the other hand, I think within Chinese parents, they have another concern is they feel like being on international students give them certain disadvantage. At least certain high school parents will think that way. So they might even think of getting their kids a green card in order to have a better chance in getting to university. I never really know whether that's true, but that's what they believe.
Right.
Yeah. Eric, you describe these students in the article we published as caught in the crossfire. They feel that they have to choose sides between China and the U.S., simply put. And choosing sides has its dangers. There's the University of Maryland student Yang Shuping, who gave a talk that many Chinese students found extremely offensive and even caused a response from the Chinese embassy. But students who express patriotism in other ways are also drawing fire. Can you comment on this?
Everyone knows about this Yang Shuping case. Okay, so it's a University of Maryland student who gave a commemoration address and talked about how, you know, once she came from this terribly polluted China and came to America, took off her mask and breathed the free air, the clean air, and
free expression and clean air.
And then she just got this horrendous backlash.
Yeah,
And she basically has been in hiding since then, I think. So yeah, that was a pretty extreme example of a student speaking out taboo political opinions in China, and there's plenty to criticize of her exact remarks. But yeah, she just had this massive pile-on where state media in China got involved, a foreign ministry spokesperson weighed in, and she was just completely vilified. Some of the students that I've interviewed have mentioned that specifically, saying that kind of makes them pause about what they would say publicly. But I think if you take that down a couple levels, some students are just worried about speaking out taboo political opinions to where they would get peer pressure. They'll look like traitors to fellow countrymen. And then some people say when they go back to China, talk to their family and friends, if they speak anything good about America or criticize China, that can kind of make them seem like a traitor. They've been brainwashed by America. Yeah, that's one side. But then, yeah, on the other side, in the U.S., there can be a lot of clashes between American and Chinese students over political issues, especially. And I think that's pretty normal, no matter what country you're talking about. But I think the U.S. and China is almost tailor-made for these kinds of clashes. Whereas I grew up in the 90s in the U.S., right after we'd won the Cold War, the Soviet Union collapsed, and I just kind of was brought up seeing democracy as the end of history, as it was called in that famous essay. And I just kind of, it would baffle me if somebody would not want to have a democratic system. That was just kind of the way I was brought up, what I was taught to believe, this kind of American exceptionalism. And then on the Chinese side, you have this patriotic education that went into effect right around the same time that really started emphasizing China's greatness in history that was stopped for a century of humiliation when the West was able to get the upper hand on China, develop more quickly, and then just subjugate it, humiliate it. But now the Communist Party has come and started to lift lift China back up to its place of world respect. But a lot of the former imperialists can't handle that. They keep wanting to keep China down. And a lot of this language is used in the education, like there's a sense of superiority in America, this arrogance and thinking that quote unquote Western democracy is the only political system. So when a lot of American students come from their background and Chinese from that background, it's like American exceptionalism versus kind of Chinese insecurity. That's almost tailor-made to have these clashes. And Chinese students said that again and again. Americans just can't accept that we might, and again, so ideologically diverse, Chinese coming here, before coming here and after coming here, a lot see huge flaws in the system, but a lot do still support one-party rule in the end after all that, even if they're critical of certain aspects of it. But a lot of American students think, well, if you still support one-party rule or any number of political issues in China, there must be some piece of information missing. You must still be brainwashed to some extent. Let me educate you about what you're missing out on. And a lot of times these American students have never been to China, don't know as much as these Chinese students who, after coming here, think quite deeply about these things. So I think it can really back a lot of Chinese students into a corner and feel.
I completely understand that feeling. I mean, I think I've said on the show before, my family traveled a fair bit in the 80s, and I, you know, grew up in apartheid South Africa. While my parents were very liberal and, you know, hated apartheid, when we were in Europe, we would often get attacked for our government by, you know, people who'd never been anywhere near the continent of Africa and didn't really know anything about South Africa. And we found it, you know, my parents, at least, I was a kid, found it difficult not to defend themselves, even though they found apartheid South Africa appalling. But when somebody you don't know buttonholes you, you know, in campus on the street and starts criticizing your country, that is a very natural reaction. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's just to be blamed on the Chinese education system.
Yeah, and I think the demographics of Chinese students here play a role in that too, like we talked about, kind of overwhelmingly now middle to upper class urban young Chinese. And for them, China's transformation has just been especially pronounced. They're some of the big winners in the system. So a lot come here thinking China's advanced really well in my lifetime.
And you guys don't have WeChat, so obviously it's wrong there.
Yeah,
but still like, using here you are, cards to pay for things.
Yeah, and then here you are bringing up human rights issues and Tibet issues, and like, who are you to challenges on that.
So I want to ask you, because it's a profoundly emotional experience to have this happen to you, right? And it's really frustrating to you when the very arguments that you want to muster in defense of this country are the ones that confirm to the American that you're brainwashed, right? I mean, it's got to be really frustrating. So tell us about your own personal experience of this in America, about trying to talk about the China that you came from. You come from Shanghai. I mean, the most shining example of what, you know, reform and opening has done for China.
Yeah, so I think the brainwash narrative is really interesting, right? Because the thing is, like, okay, you are basically, in Chinese we say, like, 里外不是人, right? Like, no one, like, you're basically rejected both here and there. Because when you go to the U.S., people assume that, oh, you're so brainwashed. Do you know about the 3T? You know, like, Tiananmen, Taiwan, right. Tibet. Like, do you know what happened, right? Like, they can't wait to educate you about everything, like, about your own country, right? So that's quite annoying. Even if you hold the exact same view as them, it's still quite annoying, right? Another person trying to say, I know better about your country. Let me tell you what happened, right? So I think, but on the other hand, as Eric said, like, you also get rejected back home because you have this, like, now progressive liberal mind about, you know, how society is supposed to be.
You become
a
baizuo.
Become a baizuo. It's like, you are stupid. You are brainwashed by the American education. So you are brainwashed by both sides. Like, who are you, right? So that is the interesting part of it. I think usually you encounter people who try to educate you a lot when they don't really know much better than you do. So that's like the annoying part, I think. Yeah.
Eric, maybe you could share what you learned from talking to Henry Cho, who you write about, who's talked about such issues quite a lot.
Oh, so yeah, he did a study at the University of Hawaii a while back, and it kind of sparked his interest when he talked to a Chinese classmate, and he was kind of like we were talking about, like trying to tell her about Tiananmen and these other issues, and got really defensive, so that kind of piqued his curiosity, and he did this qualitative study with 18 Chinese students, I think it was, really in-depth interviews, and he said, like, on some level, all of them were able to sympathize with this idea that Americans are biased or ignorant about China, and that a lot of these students, like, affirmed that when they were back in China, they were very critical of the Chinese government, and there have been studies to this effect, too, that Chinese students who are looking to study abroad, on average, have more critical view of the Chinese government than average. So yeah, they were very critical, but then when they came here, started to get challenged on these issues. One thing, there was a defense mechanism just to kind of feel this duty to defend the country. But another thing you kind of noticed is after coming here is national identity, whereas before, like, difference between the Chinese people and the Chinese government were very clear, those started to kind of mold together and just kind of wrapped up into this ball to where Chinese identity was more closely aligned with the Chinese government, the Chinese state, and whatnot. So yeah, it can be very, in a lot of ways, reinforce some degree of nationalism.
Yeah, I think it's time we talk about this CSSA, the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, and about the allegations, at least on some campuses, that they are being used by Chinese consulates, by even the embassy, to keep tabs on disloyal Chinese students or Chinese scholars. What have you guys found out about this? What do you know about the extent to which these allegations hold any water?
Well, I'd recommend there was a terrifically reported piece in Foreign Policy just recently by Bethany Allen Abrahamian. I think that was the most in-depth investigation into this thus far. It confirmed a lot of long-held suspicions. But yeah, CSSAs have long been kind of under suspicion for having ties to Chinese consulates, like some of the events we talked about, Yang Shuping. The CSSA there was one of the first to criticize her, make a video like highlighting her distortions and lies. And then in the Dalai Lama case, UC San Diego, it kind of sprang into action to protest him being there. And they made some early remarks about being in contact with the embassy over the matter, which raised a lot of eyebrows. So I think with the CSSA is, if you have this image of like an octopus being controlled by Beijing with its tentacles and all 150 some odd chapters, that's not quite accurate at all, kind of orchestrating everything. These groups are primarily student social groups. They provide a lot of very practical assistance. And frankly, in a lot of universities, they provide services that universities have fallen short on, like picking up new arrivals at the airport, helping with job things, but they do fun things like dating events, stuff like that. So with most groups, it seems, I've interviewed about a dozen officers in the CSSA at different schools. And it seems that's usually about the extent of it. They might have, or they usually do have contact with the local consulate once a year for the annual Chinese New Year party and get funded by that.
And handover of names of traitors.
I haven't heard of that, but that is possible. And a lot of what was in that Foreign Policy article, it kind of drove home how disparate the experience is. A lot of CSSAs aren't really affected at all by the influence, but a lot really are. Like there's litmus tests, political litmus tests for running for election. And there's
running
been some
for election, you know, on campus.
Within
the organization,
right?
Oh, I see.
And there's been documented cases where Chinese President Hu Jintao a couple years ago, and then Xi Jinping, when he's visiting, the CSSA will get funding from the embassy to bus students out to cheer for him, and then. Yeah, just other various patriotic activities. And there was about 2 years ago, China's Ministry of Education issued this directive. And in it, it said that consulate student groups abroad should encourage patriotic energy among study abroad students. And that was very vague. But some of the students that were interviewed for this article in Foreign Policy and have said that they felt ideological pressure since then to like send out articles to the group members, to hold activities, to watch Chinese political events. And what was really striking, I thought, from that is how a lot of the presidents and other officers were resisting that. They didn't want to comply with that. That's been interesting in my own interviews, talking to some CSSA presidents I've talked to have criticized actions of other CSSAs, saying that the Dalai Lama reaction, for example, was going too far. But then another CSSA president I talked to said, well, the government wouldn't need to tell me to do that. If that happened at our university, I would organize the exact same kind of protest. So I think very diverse in how influenced they are and what kind of activities they do. But there are definitely sorts of overreach by the Chinese consulate.
Suqi, have you had any dealings with CSSAs in school universities that you've attended?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. I think I intentionally detached from that organization because I mentioned to Eric before, I find it interesting is back to like what you said, it's a broad spectrum, but the way they're running the organization looks too similar to the way, you know, people learn, like run student groups in China or any party associate, you know, the whole hierarchy thing, the whole politics, the whole environment, the whole culture feeling of the organization feels so much like back in China. And I was baffled by it because I don't understand how that is possible. Because when I entered Columbia, I saw CSA is just, you know, a student group, which like, you know, like black students group kind of thing. You do some fun stuff together. You kind of meet people coming from the same country. Then you figure out the environment is a little bit different. I probably won't attend more events. But on the other hand, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of things they do are really just like dating events or, you know, celebrating Chinese New Year. So that doesn't sound so sketchy, or you cannot detect any link to the embassy when you're attending these events. So that's why like they're very loosely organized. It's very hard to say who are doing this out of their own patriarchy action or they're doing it because someone have told them to do so.
Let's turn to the classroom itself. You know, I think one of the complaints you hear about, especially at universities with large numbers of Chinese students, is that in a classroom setting, if there are too many mainland Chinese, it will inhibit discussion of, you know, politics, of democracy, and particularly, of course, if it comes to questions of Chinese history and politics. Is this as big a problem as some people are making it out to be?
I mean, this is definitely a separate aspect from the CSSAs, is there have been a lot of reports of professors, especially that teach sensitive topics, having students report back to higher authorities on things their classmates have said, and students getting, one professor I talked to teaches Tibetan studies, he said there was one student that said something in class and got a call within a couple hours about it. Those cases happen for sure. They're pretty rare. I don't think there's something that a lot of students worry about. But there are a lot of worries about contentious issues. And this was a huge thing in Australia last year. Mm-hmm. There were four separate incidents that happened in pretty close succession where, like in one case, a professor referred to Taiwan as a country and he was challenged by Chinese students secretly recording it. And then it blew up online. And in another case, a professor put like do not cheat on the board in English and Chinese only.
I haven't had problems with
that. Yeah. Well, in all these cases, there was a huge backlash. Sometimes CSSA was involved in promoting it, and then Chinese state media latched on. In three of the cases, the lecturers apologized later. So there's
that's all in Australia, but there have been some cases in the U.S. too, yes?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of professors too talk about incidents like that that don't blow up to quite that extent, but students getting very defensive over these issues in class. So yeah, it's a challenge. I thought it was interesting. Jonathan Sullivan, the professor at the University of Nottingham in the UK, he wrote this interesting follow-up after my article about how he kind of deals with it, because he said like 10 years ago he had an issue with this student who just stood up and said, Taiwan isn't a country. And he said he started kind of at the beginning of his classes saying, okay, we're going to talk about some sensitive issues, and I want you to try to think about why different people might have different opinions on this. We're going to interrogate the American or the Western view and the Chinese view. Any point is valid. We encourage you to speak up and try to support your stance with evidence. And he said that they talk about the three T's and all sorts of sensitive political things. He said he's never had an outburst like that. So I thought that was pretty interesting about how some professors...
That is a best practice that ought to be shared. I mean, it's a very good one.
But there are anecdotal stories about professors kind of being scared to speak up because of some of the backlash that you've seen. But there are people that argue, like those four cases in Australia, the backlash wasn't an affront to freedom of speech, but an exercise of it by Chinese students with different points of view. So I don't know. I don't take a position on it, but I thought that was kind of an interesting thing.
I also think like from teachers' point of view, there's like different ways of dealing with these issues, right? Like I feel like especially in some of the Australian case, To be honest, it was because the teacher was ignorant enough to kind of fall into certain stereotype of China and then promoting it, and the students are unhappy about it. So I think you can, like what you mentioned, the Notting Hill case is really good, as like the professor should expect that students going to have different opinions, and you just need to deal with it. Because what I see is there is still a power dynamic, right? The professors still have way more power than the students in the classroom. There is like basically you are in control, then you need to be somewhat sensitive about students' feeling. You know, it might be the first time they're taking in this information. You need to kind of prep them to, you know, learn new things. That's the way to, you know, ask them to open new perspectives, to open for other possibilities to understand China better, right?
I might add to those four incidents, the aftermath of those was pretty extreme in Australia. There were headlines in newspapers that said, like, there's a war being waged by Chinese students against their Australian lecturers, or like Australian teachers are increasingly coming under attack by Chinese students, and very kind of generalized. And I mean, these were a very small number of cases. These were four cases out of, I think it's like 150,000 Chinese students in Australia. So there was kind of this narrative that came out afterwards where you did have a very small group of Chinese students setting the tone for the entire cohort. And I think that was kind of true here as well with like the Dalai Lama deal with Yang Shuping, where you had a small but very, very vocal minority speaking out and kind of setting the impression for the larger Chinese population, many of which have were criticizing much more quietly the reaction of those students or just totally disengaged.
Well, this is a problem that I think all open societies are going to be having, as we have people from non-pluralist societies coming in. And is it the right thing to do maybe to talk to people as they come in, to explain to them, you know, give them a primer on, I mean, I don't think they're getting it necessarily when they come what to expect in an American university classroom. I think that maybe inoculating them in the way that professor did, but not just class by class, but sort of as an incoming student to a university.
Yeah, I think some universities start to have this like kind of bridge program, you know, kind of to prepare you culturally, right? It's like, oh, this is how American culture is different from Chinese culture, you know, like, or you need to be more active in classroom, like you might be open to different views, you know. I think some universities start to build that into their institutional setting, but maybe not like enough yet.
So right now, the political environment as it is, I think it's fair to say that there's a gigantic debate underway about all sorts of facets of the U.S.-China relationship, whether it's trade or strategic relationship or what have you. How is this all playing out in the Chinese student community? They have a lot that's personally at stake in how things end up going, and one would think that they would be maybe more incentivized to now get involved. Are either of you seeing more involvement by students in this broader topic of U.S.-China relations? Are there, you know, or is it all the complexities, the hairy nature of these issues? Are they keeping their heads down below the parapet and afraid to speak out? I mean, how is this affecting it?
I haven't heard a lot of reaction from Chinese students. Like, there have been a couple, like, this has kind of ramped up in just the past few weeks. Like you mentioned, like, the FBI director mentioning the whole of society threat coming from China, and some U.S. politicians are starting to take on this issue now. I haven't heard a lot. I spent, like, the last 2 weeks interviewing probably 2 to 3 dozen Chinese students. I brought this up with all of them, and not a whole lot were aware of this kind of building a political backlash to it. I think the Australian case is different. That's started earlier. The scholars I've talked to that are studying Chinese students there say that they seem to be a lot more aware of it. You have more senior officials there. Their foreign minister made some remarks a couple months ago. So I think those students are starting to kind of feel the heat more. I think we could very easily get there in the not too distant future if you start seeing this work its way up to more senior political figures becoming more of a mainstream media issue. But I don't think a ton are too put off by it just yet, in this country at least, but I don't know.
Yeah, because I feel like at least from my own like social media kind of, you know, circle, I didn't see enough people commenting on both issues, the political issues within China. I think that has a reason, because I feel like less and less people start to speak up their mind on WeChat, because you feel that it's more and more censored than before, you know, like, and so I think people are getting more and more cautious about speaking out on certain issues. And for the FBI case, I just feel like it doesn't get enough attention from the Chinese community. Not a lot of people has been talking about it and feel like, oh, they are treating us as a threat. How should we respond? I've never heard anything about it.
Can I perhaps ask a last question about Confucius Institutes? Not exactly the subject we're talking about, but very much related. What do the two of you make of the debate about Confucius Institutes on American university campuses?
I don't have a lot of opinion either way. I think it's very interesting. But I think if you're worried about Chinese government influence in the U.S., I think a lot of the worry with the Confucius Institute are that like education about China and they're being watered down. There are certain taboo topics that they're avoiding and certain hiring practices that are raising a lot of eyebrows. So I think the concern with those is more that they're like brainwashing American students in education about China. But I think if you're concerned about...
Which is a patently ridiculous concern. I've been, my entire career has been trying to brainwash Americans about China, and it's not that easy.
No. So I think if that's their goal, I mean, they spend billions and billions on these Confucius Institutes. I don't know how good their ROI is on that brainwashing attempt. But I mean, it's a perfectly valid concern, though, just on principle, if they are in universities and you're substituting more critical academic freedom to have these institutes that are paid for by the Chinese government. But if you're worried about Chinese government influence, I think that's not a huge, that's not as big of a concern as what's being done related to Chinese students themselves, like we talked about earlier, trying to keep Chinese students in line one way or another, monitoring. I think that's probably a bit more of a risky, quote-unquote, influence operation, but it seems the Confucius Institutes are getting the lion's share of the political attention, at least.
I mean, which is, as Jeremy says, it's patently absurd. What happened to agency? I mean, don't we, I mean, are we just sit here helplessly as the sinister Chinese government reaches in and brainwashes? I mean, come on, really? Are we so worried about that? I keep coming back to this one basic point, which is that if we're really worried about the integrity of the American civic fabric, what is more likely to do harm to it? These ham-fisted, mostly stupid efforts to influence American society that are, you know, spun out in Beijing, or our own paranoia, our propensity to, you know, fall into McCarthyist-style witch hunting. This is a country, after all, which was gunning down turbaned Sikhs who are not, by the way, Muslim after September 11th. This is a country, you know, where we can very easily make these sorts of mistakes. I think the threat to the civic fabric comes much more from the sort of red scaremongering that we're hearing way too much of. While these issues are serious and should be taken seriously, I think the way that our guests today have treated them is, I think, a very good one. So Eric and Sichi, I want to thank you both for joining us here at the China Institute and for taking the time. And I also want to thank the good folks at the China Institute for co-sponsoring this event and for hosting. So let's hear it for our guests and for the China Institute. Yeah. And let's then move on to recommendations. But before we do, I want to remind our listeners that, cue music, the Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina. Sign up for our free daily email newsletter. Become an access member for all sorts of great bonus stuff, including early and free releases of this very podcast. And, of course, make sure to go and leave Seneca a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store. It really helps people to discover this podcast, something more important than ever as the U.S. and China drift toward the proverbial rocks. On to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off.
All right, I've got one. I don't know if any single listener of ours will actually be interested in this, but if there's one person is interested in it, it will be worth it. I live on in a holler in outside of Nashville, and there's no sewerage, so I'm building a house. And getting a septic tank permit is, you know, I thought I was living in a Republican state and there was like no regulations or anything, but that is clearly not the case. It's very difficult to get a septic permit. So I've had to do research into toilet alternatives, and I've discovered this amazing world of toilets that don't require you to be plugged into the grid. And there are two that are really great. The one is the Sunmar composting toilet, which basically turns your poop into compost, which you can use to then, you know, grow your flowers or your crops. And the other one is called the EcoJohn Incinerator, which I have coming by delivery, hopefully, when I get back to Nashville. It's this huge box that basically takes gray water, which is shower and dishwater, and black water, which is toilet water, puts them in a big box and burns it to ash. And
wait,
you're left with
burns
some
water.
So, yeah. So I know this is an odd recommendation, but if there's anybody listening who's struggling to either get a septic tank permit or doesn't know how to put a toilet in a place,
I'm
with
struggling
no sewerage,
to make sense of burning
EcoJohn
water.
EcoJohn and Sunma are your friends.
Okay, that may be the loopiest recommendation we've ever had on the show. But thank you very much, Jeremy. And that it should come from you is no surprise at all. Sushi, why don't you tell us?
Yeah,
what you have
sure.
For us?
So I'm going to recommend a novel by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Americana.
That novel
published 2013. I found it really relevant to our today's topic. You know, it's like, it's more like a universal experience of foreign national who come into the U.S. to study and find, oh, how they're now I need to figure out my racial identity in the societies and how others see me as a Nigerian. That's who she is. And then she also have a reverse culture shock, like moving back to the, you know, top echelon of Nigeria society in Lagos. So she it's also a really, really well-written love story. So if you have some spare time, I strongly recommend it.
It's one of my favorite novels. And one of the best part of it is that blog that she writes, which she's in America.
Yeah, yeah.
She writes this blog, which is basically explaining black Africans to African American blacks.
Yeah, yeah. And explain, also,
I mean, it's brilliant. It's so funny. And it's just.
And I also think that's really beneficial if there's any Chinese students listen to it. I think it's actually pretty beneficial to try to connect your own experience to other, you know, foreign nationals, not like trying to focus too much on your own like Chinese student experience, only like, you know, how does US-China relationship to do with it? Try to connect it to a broader, you know, racial story of the society. You might find another new word.
That is such wise and great advice. Yeah, absolutely. I thought the same thing as I read that book. I kept thinking, you know, anyway. great. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And her other novels too. Half of a Yellow Sun. Absolutely great. Purple Hibiscus. They're great novels.
So I'm going to recommend a book that's a couple years old as well, called Fortunate Sons, the 120 Chinese boys who came to America, went to school, and revolutionized an ancient civilization. So this is a book
very
about...
Very relevant.
Yeah, so in 1872, this, what's kind of considered the first group of Chinese students in America, came over, and they were sent back early, and it kind of, I think there's a lot of interesting parallels and differences between today and then, and at that time, kind of reformist forces and conservatives within the Chinese government at that time clashing over these students, and how some of them adopted American culture full on and some resisted, and just a very charming historical nonfiction about this group of students.
Eric, in the sunset of your life, you can write a book called Fortunate Four Die about the, the 300,000 Chinese students who came to America and shamed their home culture by driving around in Maseratis and whatever, you know. Okay, great. So my recommendation is this book right here. It's called America, Right or Wrong, An Anatomy of American Nationalism. That's right, you heard it, American Nationalism. This is the second edition, which was written still. I mean, it published about 6 years ago, and it was incredibly prescient. It talks about, the author's name is Anatole Levin, L-I-E-V-E-N, an incredible book. I'm only about a third of the way through with it right now, but I just keep like standing up and going, oh my God, why haven't I read this before? Why didn't I read this? Anyway, it presages this whole phenomenon of Trumpism like you wouldn't believe. And cannot recommend it more highly. It's just absolutely fascinating. If you don't believe that there is such a thing as American nationalism, there are really two strains. I mean, he talks about the American nationalist thesis and the antithesis. The antithesis we're all deeply familiar with now, because it's the, you know, strident America first sort of ethno-nationalist nationalism of the Trumpers. But the American nationalist thesis is what, you know, sort of more what we were talking about, the American exceptionalist idea. And it's a noble one, you know, about pluralism, about democracy, about the universality of American values. But it is also one that has a certain hubris, a certain arrogance, a certain a failure to sort of examine the historical context out of which that emerged. And this book is just absolutely great. So that's what I got for y'all. And with that, thanks once more to Sisi Tu.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And Eric Fish.
Yeah. Thank you.
For your insights into this incredibly important issue, and thanks again to the China Institute for having us back. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and that guy over there, Jeremy Goldcorn.
It took you too long.
I'll edit out the pause. Don't worry. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook at SubChina News. Make sure to go and check out the other podcasts in our growing series of podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief and the GGV 996 podcast, which covers technology and investing in China. We co-produce that with our friends at the venture capital outfit GGV. Thank you very much for listening. We will see you next week. Take care. Thanks, everyone.